definitions, he calls it like it should. One of the things that the computer, the purpose of this whatever computation should be its purpose. So like a coffee machine makes coffee. That's the purpose of a coffee machine. Mm-hmm. So if I were to define a computer or something, or an aspect which requires computation, then I would define it that this has, in philosophy it's called the teleological purpose, but this is like its purpose should be computation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. Then the definition given by Piccinini is around like it should be a teleological, that's what I meant by the medium independent vehicles of computation, so things that carry computation. This is a mm-hmm. definition of physical computation, that means something physical computing, whether it's biology, whether it's a quantum mm-hmm. device, whether it's your mm-hmm. brain or something like that. So there should be medium independent vehicles, where vehicles mean what carry the computations,
mm-hmm.
and they should be independent of the media, and their purpose is to compute.
Mm-hmm.
That's one sentence, but it's a very, like, it takes a whole book to define it.
Yes, that sounds like philosophy.
Okay.
So you kind of touched on this, but has the quantum revolution, as you alluded to, kind of changed the discussion around defining computation?
I think a lot of the work for computation, especially quantum computation, was done a long time back. Like, especially when you're talking about theorizing, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So people did a lot of work on that. And so it will be really, that's one of the things I'm also interested in, is like, if we were to come up with a definition of biological computation, that would require you to like also look at something physical like a quantum computer and see that, oh, maybe we can learn something of how people have defined what does it mean to physically compute in a quantum computer to help us define something in the biological world, because biology is a physical concept and then so is a quantum computer, very physical. I don't know.
Would it be like defining the different sorts of logic that you can possibly, I don't know if the definition of a computation involves any sort of logical set, or if it's just, I don't know, more to the like teleological,
yeah.
And kind of logic independent. But that's like the difference that I can think of with a quantum computation versus a classical one, is the logic set is a little different.
It's different, yeah. But even then, logic is something that is medium independent and is more abstract.
Yeah,
right? And we construct a quantum computer, but if we were to find a quantum computer out in the wild,
mm-hmm.
and how would we like then go about defining how something computes from there? Suppose you had access to transistors and like these things, but you didn't have any theory of computation. Somewhere in the future, humanity has collapsed. There are these alien archaeologists who have no concept of computation, and then they see computers.
Mm.
How are they going to come up with a theory of computation from there?
Mm-hmm.
Is
mm-hmm.
a question, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
There was no Turing, all that, all the books have been destroyed, everything. Maybe it's a good sci-fi plot, who knows?
Yeah, that's like a good sci-fi plot.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it could be an exciting new way to like probe these
yeah.
definitions.
So that's why we're coming backwards from biology. We're like, maybe it's just we're trying to force. We know that the brain is doing some form of computation, but like, how do we define it? So we have everything like the transistors and all the thing, but we don't have the knowledge of computation. So we're going from down to up instead of how humanity developed it from top to down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sort of on the topic of biological computation, there is a research initiative at U of I called Mind in Vitro. That applies insights from statistical physics to help understand the human brain. And you've sort of been involved with this work. Can you kind of like explain that a little bit more?
So I've not actually been directly involved with this work. Mm-hmm. And I heard of it. And there was a professor, Lav Varshney, who I reached out to one time and talked to him for a bit about it. But my interest is purely, so Karen Dahman in the physics department is involved with that group, and my interest is I'm in the process of like writing a white paper for them to try and do like thermodynamics of computation. So trying to do philosophy and like trying to figure out biological computation itself is like super hard. So I thought, you know what, there is some work that has recently been done on what's the heat cost of computers, and what's the heat cost of circuits. And I'm like, oh, you know what, this is cool work. I'm going to learn this math, and a lot of it is very familiar to people with statistical physics already. And why don't we test this with the Mind in Vitro project, in which they are making neural computers from in petri dishes. They're basically making logic gates out of like neurons. And that'd be cool to try. So I'm in the process of finishing up like a white paper and like write down. Now that it's on air, I have to finish it.
Exactly. This is, now you're on the record.
Now I'm on the record. So maybe this will give me the motivation I need to like actually write down a proper white paper. But then, yeah, and pitch it to them of like, you know what, let's try and calculate the heat cost of the logic that is being done in these circuits.
Yeah. Can I get a visual for like what you mean by heat cost?
Yes. So, heat cost would be like, so what is, I'll start with a very simple question, which is, suppose you were to flip a bit, okay, now if you go with that logic of changing one to zero, what's the thermodynamic, by heat cost I mean, what's the thermodynamic Q value heat that changes upon conducting this bit flip.
Yeah, so just for like a little bit of context in thermodynamics, there is there are relationships that equate like information being lost or gained to heat being lost or gained. So you can sort of think about like changing information as equivalent to like gaining or losing heat.
So I'll give you a very explicit example. So entropy can be written as this minus KB sum of PI log PI, right? Which is basically the average information log. And so you can, if you have a probability that's changing, say in biology you write down a master equation, right? You write dp over dt or any sort of change in probability. So you can write down dp over dt, and because this probability is changing, you can also write down ds over dt, which is the change in entropy, because s is just a function of the probabilities. And then when you integrate it, you get the change in entropy, and then the change in entropy is related to the heat. So actually, why I use the master equation is because when you use, when you write down the dp over dt in the master equation format, the entropy you get from it, you get a purely positive term, and then you get a change flux term. So you get a source and you get a flux. And so you can then integrate and figure out, okay, this is the heat gained or lost from the system.
So for a little bit more context, entropy is a measure of disorder in a system in thermodynamics, and you can think of like an increase of heat as increasing disorder in some cases. So yeah, I don't know if this is related at all, but we, last time we spoke, we kind of touched on the idea of just like how incredible of a computer the human brain is. Like it can do, I think to double check this, but I believe it can do like an exaflop, which is like a billion flops in a second at really low, at really high efficiency. So like with the power that it takes to power a light bulb.
Exactly. So that was like the one of the motivations of the thermodynamics of computation, definitely, is to do the same kind of calculation you can do at a supercomputer for, say, you're doing computer vision, finding out what each of these objects are. I'm speaking at the same time. I'm listening to Maddie, and I'm like, yeah, all these things a supercomputer might take a long time to do.
And with much with required much more power, like the amount of the power that like it takes to power a city or something.
Yeah, it would take the electricity of Illinois. And yeah. Whereas you can do like some of those calculations with like one cup of coffee or like just a bowl of like peanuts. I don't know. Just a very low. Our calorie requirement is a lot less for the same kind of computer. Of course, it's doing a different. I won't make you do like matrix multiplications, which are super complicated. Really good. But it's really interesting, right? What comes very easy to us is very hard for a computer, but what comes very easy to a computer is very hard for us. So, for example, like doing matrix calculations are hard for us.
Right.
It's easy
yeah.
for a computer. I guess that's why we made a computer to make things which are difficult for us easy. So it's kind of the opposite I'm talking about. But
yeah.
And so on the beauty of the brain as a computer as well is that there's a paper which tells you even a single dendrite of a neuron of a human neuron can do what is known as a exclusive OR gate, which those of you viewers who are listeners who have taken a machine learning course or any I've heard about the AI winter, and that happened because in the very first iteration of the perceptron they could not resolve the XOR gate, but a human single dendrite could do it.
What is a perceptron?
Yes, so a perceptron is the first layer of a neural network. Imagine a single layered neural network.
Okay, gotcha.
In which all you do is just sum different output. So it's like the output layer. Imagine this.
Yeah.
The output layer.
Okay.
Yeah. So then people thought about stacking multiple perceptrons together, and then adding that non-linearity which was missing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the neural network came. But before that, the first thing was it was drawing a straight line in this n-dimensional space. And you can't draw a straight line to differentiate a XOR gate, was the explicit definition. But yeah, your human dendrite, but a rat's dendrite can't do that. And so this was shown in by this group in Greece. And so the human brain not only has a lot more neurons than a rat and is a lot more complex, but even a single dendrite is a lot more complex and can do a lot more computation. It was said that a single neuron, I don't know, I'd have to double check, is like a seven-layer neural network to do the same kind of computation. But I don't know, like this, again, I have to verify it, so
don't
quote me on this.
Yeah. So the white paper that you're writing or the research questions that you're interested in around the statistical physics or like heat costs associated with computation, what in particular, what questions are you interested in?
Yeah, so I definitely want to try and answer why the brain can work on a bowl of porridge. And
yes, yes.
That's definitely cool. Also, from the machine learning aspect, that, you know, the machine learning is a lot of heat costs and that's not good for the environment. So
Yes. This is a huge conversation in environmental fields. I don't know as much in
and AI and ethics.
Yeah absolutely, because like just the carbon cost of AI is just enormous. Yeah,
so if we can help reduce that or like at least understand it, that's the first step.
Mm-hmm.
Is to like understand, okay, what now do the thermodynamics of a neural network or a deep learning network, and see what's there.
Yeah that would be amazing.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Plus, it's my from a career standpoint, it's also a way to like get into like non-equilibrium physics, because computation is non-equilibrium. It's a non-equilibrium thing. You have to change a bit, and you have to add energy to it. To flip it, and so it is an inherently a non-equilibrium process. And so, doing some of the math and like trying to understand that would also help me get into that field.
So to be clear, is like another way to put it that dendrites and neurons are much more efficient than a regular computer?
I don't know.
Or is it? Okay.
We don't know. Like, well, how do we define efficiency?
I guess it's like energy in and how much of that gets put towards the computation.
Yeah, but we'll have to find like a comparison for like a computation. So we make a neuron do, so the mind in vitro group would really be helpful there. You would make a neuron do a logical OR gate calculation maybe, and then you make a computer do that. Maybe the computer is faster for simple computations, and then you'll have to scale up and find at what point is there an advantage. Electricity is definitely faster than your brain's.
Okay, so we don't actually know like how many bits our brains are computing necessarily.
Yeah, or how do we define a bit for
I see.
I am looking at you and talking now.
Yeah, can how many define, bits?
Yeah, what's the stream of information here?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, it's a tough problem.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
But really cool and exciting, and I hope that
my advisor
you get funding.
Doesn't know about this, so.
Well, they will now.
Exciting news, yeah. No, but this is something I'm really interested and passionate about. But.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Cool. So we also wanted to talk about sort of like community organizing and activism, because you've been super involved with that during your undergrad and also your grad here. So we were wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the Education Justice Project.
Yeah, Education Justice Project. Definitely quite a few physics people have been involved in the past in it, and I think currently are also involved.
Oh,
and
that's great.
I'm more than happy, like, if any of you in physics, definitely do it as an experience. So the Education Justice Project, it brings, so if you as a graduate student or a faculty can like teach courses at the Danville Correctional Center, which is 1 hour east from here, I think. So what I was involved in, I was a writing and math partner, and it's the easiest way to get involved if you're a STEM student, is through writing and math partner, where you help the students at the correctional center with their writing assignments. It's like holding office hours. You help them with math. It's a lot of fun. You get to meet really cool people, and then the students are also amazing. And of course, I mean, it's you also realize how brutal the prison system is, and it's a horrible, horrible thing. And there's a dose of that too. And I also feel like I am very, very privileged. Like, studying in a university is a huge privilege.
Absolutely.
And you doing physics and you doing a PhD in physics is a very, very privileged thing to do. Who can pause their lives and be detached from their family for 6 years?
Yeah, and there's like also do a something huge you want to do. Opportunity costs associated with PhD, because you could be,
Your family might need you.
Yeah.
Plain and simple. Like, not everyone's family are happy enough that a working individual at a working and earnable age is taken off.
Absolutely. It's
right. So it's a huge privilege. It's enormous privilege to do this, and so, you have a duty, or at least a sense that you should share some of that with the people who don't have that privilege, and one of the least privileged people who don't have access to education is the prison population.
Yeah.
And I need to do this. So I'm a kind of person who, like, if I were to eat with anyone, I can't, like, my food won't digest if I do not share it with someone. I felt very uneasy not doing something when I was learning physics here. Like, I should, like, help someone out, tutor someone who's, like, really needs it. And this Education Justice Project just was the perfect opportunity for me to, like, be at ease with that conflict.
Yeah.
And so, I got really busy now, so I've not been to the correctional facility, but... I do miss the students there. One of them even wrote a book, and so I bought it off Amazon.
Oh my gosh. So awesome. What is the title of the book, and where can we find it?
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon. It's called What Would You Do If You Were Me? And it's by full name. I can let you know.
Well, we'll add it in the notes.
Yeah, we'll add it in the notes. We can put it on screen if you're watching video.
Yes. What would you do? Somewhere here. What would you do if you were me? And it's a book in which he talks about his experience in prison. And every chapter is a short experience he had. Mm-hmm. And he asked at the end of every chapter, what would you do if you were me?
Yeah.
In, put you in that situation. In that, it's beautifully written and definitely, it's great.
Yeah, that's really beautifully put. And I think a lot of us like share that feeling of just our awareness of how like privileged we are to be able to be in a PhD program. And I think that is really beautiful that you were able to give back. Yeah.
How often did you end up going up to seeing your students?
So this was, you could do it once or twice a month. And I didn't have a car, but if you have a car, then you can even build an entire course you want to teach and students will get credit for it.
Okay.
So
that's fantastic.
This is good, yeah.
For those of you who want to add teaching experience and want to also do good, this is a great experience to like, come up with the, of course it'll be vetted by the University of Illinois.
Yeah.
And come up with the course. Matt Zhang, who was a student before me, he made a machine learning course. And he taught machine learning to the students there. And they liked it. So come up with courses. Of course, you can do even simple things like algebra or like even mathematics courses or to like highly complicated stuff. Students will sign up, they'll get credit for it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
You can teach them.
So if someone wants to get involved, is there someone they can contact? Or
yes, just Google Education Justice Project UIUC and there's a whole page for it.
Yeah, and we'll put a link.
That's fantastic.
Thank you so much for telling us about your experience. Oh, for sure.
I really like those folks there. And Professor Rebecca, who like runs this, is amazing.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about Each One Teach One?
Oh.
Yes. This is so sweet.
Yeah.
I love
this. This was... So after first year, around my second year, we were trying to organize something for my peers and like to be able to read a book together or learn something. Then we realized that, you know, all of us work in like these different fields, and it'd be great if like we got together once a week and just told us what you learned over there, because as first, second year grad students, you're doing a lot of learning.
Yes.
And of course you're learning about your field, but another aspect is that I learn by teaching. Like, I really like to write lecture notes or some form of notes in the form of pedagogical teaching way. Mm. And that's how I learn a subject. So this was a great opportunity in which we set up a group where each one would teach one, in that the sense is, it's actually Each One Teach All, I guess. I mean, I don't know, because but it would be Teach One too, because like sometimes you'd want to go one-on-one. But the idea was you would collect everyone, would spread out and learn cool things every week, and then you'd come back once a week and someone would just give a lecture on the board, or like you would talk and share what have you learned in the previous week. And this way, not only are you learning about your field, which you're doing every week, you're also quickly expanding your knowledge at a pace faster. So, again, it's like tapping into not just your individual intelligence, but the collective intelligence of a group, which is going to be emergent and higher.
There we go.
Than your own individual one. So.
Yeah, I feel like that's a lot more common in the PhD, to do those like journal clubs and just more sort of like general interest groups in your first year or two. But I think that would be great. I'm in my fifth year. Mari's in fifth year.
Yeah, fifth year.
We're all up there.
We're all up there.
And I feel like I would love to do something like that now. Yeah, I think it's still super.
Yeah, we could set something up like that, you know.
We could.
Yeah.
I'd be down.
I love. Yeah. I would definitely be down. We'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that.
Yes, like my thesis is like so interdisciplinary, so I'm always kind of like I'm always trying to learn things from like communications folks, like tribal leaders, like and I think a lot of our work is pretty interdisciplinary. So, and it's just, I feel like really helpful to know kind of what the discourse is in other fields, because there often is a lot more overlap than you think. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Bring back each one. Teach one. All.
Yes, teach all. Yes.
Teach one. Teach all.
Yes.
Okay. So we also would love to know a little bit more about the two books that you'd like to write after graduation.
Ah, yes. So part of that, I really want to write a book on how to, like, I wanted to call it Conquering the Physics PhD.
Yes.
But I want to conquer it first, and this is a throwback to Yoni Kan's book, Conquering the Physics GRE.
Yes,
physics so professor at the University of Illinois.
Who is a physics professor here? Exactly. So I wanted to write that one. So after people finish their Conquering the Physics GRE, they should pick up Conquering the Physics PhD. Maybe I should talk to Yoni about it before I publish it.
copyright
issues. But the idea is, I learned a lot. I struggled a lot during the PhD program. I changed advisors. I also collected, because I talked to a lot of people, I collected a lot of good advice from a lot of people. I read books on it. And so I want to make a compendium of what should you do in your first year, what should you do in your second year, what should you do in your third year. Just rough guidelines. And just give stuff, very simple advice, like, you know what, when you enter the program or when you enter a group, the group leader, who's your professor, would likely just give you papers to read. You shouldn't do that. Just read their students' theses, read their grants, read like those things, which will give you an idea of the group a lot more. When you're applying for a group or you're applying to a place, you know, you can look at the grants awarded at NSF website, see and read the abstract, read the introduction. You will know what your project is because that grant is now funded. So that'll give you a lot more better idea than the website that's like 10 years ago, updated, 2017 or whatever. Those things are like ways to get just some random advice and tidbits. The other book I wanted to write was on non-equilibrium physics. And so this is, you know, Steven Weinberg wrote his GR book because he wanted to learn GR. And so he wrote a textbook about it. Of course, I'm no Steven Weinberg. And I'll be taking lots of help from other people. And it'll be like a group effort, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write like rough guide, like rough textbook or something for non-equilibrium physics, because it's a lot of material and it's all over the place. There's climate science, there's computation, there is critical phenomena, there is these quantum stuff which is non-equilibrium, you have the Floquet physics, you have, and everything either has a textbook of its own or a review paper of its own, or like this field just all over the place. So even if I'm like writing a 1,000-page book, but like at least have some form of pedagogical rough non-equilibrium physics book. You know what? Yeah, there's fluid mechanics here, there's quantum here, there's like, you can break it down into classical and quantum, and then people would have a good idea and then could then explore the relevant review papers if they wanted to. I mean, they'll all be written or linked there. So, so basically like more like a collection.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And you touched on this a little bit in when you were talking about the first book that you wanted to write, but I was wondering if you had any more advice that you would give to young scientists or young researchers.
Oh, advice. So one thing to note about advice, and also with the book I would write, is that everyone who gives you advice or gives you any sort of like, whoever gives you advice is giving you what they could have, should have, or would have done.
So, could have, would have, should have. There's only one way to learn, and okay. That's the